Welcome to the 131st episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as America decides its next president, welcome to the podcast that hopes the US doesn't need a super over.
So as the world changes around us, one thing that you can be certain of is that Reverse Rep Radio will be here with the cricket trivia and stories that you never knew you wanted to hear, but we're going to tell you anyway. So we're going to do a little roundup of what's caught our eye in the last fortnight, as we always do to start our episodes. I'm going to be delving into the history of the Lord's Bell. And we're going to review On Cricket by Mike Brilley. It was called Delightful by the Times and Powerful by the Sunday Express. And in about 20 minutes' time, we'll give you our opinion on that book. Andy, you've got a Zimbabwean connection going back a little bit, and you've been keeping your eye on the latest side.
Yeah, so Zimbabwe had been out in Pakistan for a tour. And if you read Cricinfo's report of Pakistan's narrow victory in the first ODI, you'd see that it described Brendan Taylor as one of the most inventive shot makers of this generation. Now, that may sound like a big call and it may strike you as flattery, but then consider how many others can casually scoop a 90-mile-an-hour Yorker over short third man or uppercut a bouncer for six with just the tiniest flick. I had the chance to catch some of this game, and it really was quite a reminder of some of these extraordinary players who, perhaps by virtue of where they've ended up playing, haven't always had the attention they deserve.
And he's young, isn't he? Because that's what always strikes me about those kinds of shots, is the presence of mind you need to have that much time on the ball is quite extraordinary. And Brendan Taylor is pretty young. He's still at the beginning of his career, isn't he?
No. Taylor is more at the other end. He's kind of been there, done that a bit for Zimbabwe, and has actually sort of having a bit of a kind of second life. But he was in partnership with a kind of young tyro, Wesley Madaveri, who came into the situation with the game very much lost. And to be fair, Zimbabwe did go on to lose the game. But between them, they made quite a chase of it. The 20-year-old struck a runnable 50, and it was just such a joy to watch. There's something about watching a young player coming into a scene that they should find daunting, taking it all in their stride. We had swaggering stroke play, and as much as anything, we had a constant smile. And I hope we get to see an awful lot more of him, because he does look like a real talent.
And how did they look in terms of the overall Zimbabwean setup? Did you have a sense of hope as to where that team as a whole would go?
Well, with Zimbabwe, the team constantly seemed to defy what's going on elsewhere in the country by consistently coming up with an 11 that actually is competitive. They won the final ODI, so, I mean, a very respectable result in the end. They lost the series 2-1, but were competitive in all three games. I think there's certainly hope for them against what was, you know, a decent Pakistan side in unfamiliar conditions. Nice, by the way, as a side note, to see cricket in Pakistan. I mean, very sad, as with everything at the moment, that there wasn't an excited Pakistani crowd in there to watch it. But great to see international cricket back there. Now, you've been enjoying... cricket is fantastic at this, actually, maybe more than any other sports. You've been enjoying a best-of list from Cricinfo.
I love a list. The thing about lists is that they just... You know, there's the opportunity to kind of debate and come up with arbitrary decisions about who's better than who. I mean, it's endless, because no one can be right when you put a list together. But Cricinfo recently have, over a series of weeks, a new release each week, been counting down from 20 to 1 in the list of balls of the century. And I think it's actually a genius idea, because it's not, in a way it feels obvious, but also in a way it's not obvious. You know, we talk about bowlers or spells or performances, but actual individual balls is a really interesting concept and a really interesting angle. So each of the articles, as they count down from 20 to 1, has a you know, they set out the background to the ball, they have a highlights video, there are a few animations kind of explainers of the ball, of exactly what went on at that time. And they also go back and interview a whole lot of the bowlers as well and ask them about what was going through their head at that time, you know, how they set it up. And what's great about it, as much as anything, is that you get to revisit these moments and realize quite how much cricket has happened over the last 20 years. There are some that feel like they're absolutely ancient history, and some that feel like they were just yesterday. There's moments like revisiting Panesar's extraordinary joy after he bowled Tendulkar. Bumrah's, and I was actually there for it, his slower ball to Sean Marsh at the MCG, Akhtar reverse swinging York to Gilchrist in 2002. All of these absolutely amazing moments. It's a rabbit hole, which is just an absolute delight to go down. In a year when there's been so much content on the internet, a whole lot of it absolute crap, this is one of these ones. It's just a joy to actually spend some time delving into.
The interesting thing is we're now getting to the age where some of this wonderful cricket that we saw when we were a little bit younger is now part of cricketing history, which is both sort of reassuring and alarming. Have you a clear favourite out of those that you've seen so far? Is there a standout?
So I haven't actually checked up on it for the last week and a half. So I think I got down to ball. It was the Warne ball to Strauss, you know, the kind of repeat of the Gatting ball, which was the recent one, which was at number sort of 4 or 5. And I was actually racking my brains to think about what the balls above that might be. And that's one of the joys of this, is that it is actually pretty unexpected, because we don't necessarily think in terms of individual balls in this way. So I don't know. What do you reckon? What would you put it? Put you on the spot here entirely. Is there something that springs into your mind as a number one ball?
Well, you made me think, talking about the Bumrah slower ball, I always sort of have incredible fond memories of that Harmison slower ball to get Clark at Edgbaston back in the 2005 Ashes. There's something about the audacity of a slower ball, isn't there? Obviously, I love a ball that with outrageous spin or outrageous swing or outrageous pace. But yes, there's something about a slower ball in that situation that's rather good.
And what's nice about this series is it sets up the context in such a way that you realise, because any ball in and of itself isn't necessarily remarkable unless it is a Warne ball to Gatting and it spins a country mile. The thing that makes it remarkable is a slower ball in a context of enormous pressure, for instance, being able to bowl that ball at that moment. And that's one of the nice things about this series, is it really sets up that context.
From the archives, in this episode, Toby is going to take us through the history of a famous instrument at the home of cricket.
So cricket is full of traditions, but sometimes you notice them and sometimes you don't. And the other day, I was watching some highlights from Lords. It was a grey Sunday afternoon, and my eye was caught by the bell that they ring 5 minutes before the start of play on every day of the Test match. And I suddenly thought to myself, I know that it's there, it's part of the furniture of cricket at Lord's, but what is the story behind that bell? And I thought, what a great feature from the archives on Reverse Swept Radio. So here we are. We know the tradition that it's rung 5 minutes before the start of play on every day of the Test match. And I always assumed that that went back centuries. But in fact, it only goes back to 2007. Before that, just some steward who happened to be rostered on for that day would ring it in order to, you know, wake up the members who were having a snooze and to let the players know that they need to lace up their boots. But it was just a very kind of low-key affair. It was just part of the routine of the day. But on the 17th of May 2007, that all changed. It was a Test match against the West Indies. And interestingly, the first person to ring the bell wasn't some glamorous ex-player. It was the ex-producer of Test Match Special, Peter Baxter. And this in and of itself indicates that it was hardly a kind of celebrity affair. I went back and, you know, diligent in my research as I always am, I looked through the over-by-over on both The Guardian and Crick Info for that match, and they don't even mention the ringing of the bell. So it wasn't as if there was some big press call or something around this. It seems like it started off as a very low-key thing.
Although actually it's interesting, because it clearly took someone to have the idea, didn't it? I mean, because it's quite an interesting idea how you change this from, you know, a kind of routine admin task for a steward to a sort of ceremonial thing. I mean, oddly, it reminds me a little bit of, there's a lot of fuss in the US, in baseball, you have the ceremonial throwing of the pitch, and that's a sort of tradition that's kind of grown and grown and grown. And I suppose these things, at the start, they take someone to have had that idea that you turn something mundane into something ceremonial, I guess.
Well, actually, and this is the interesting thing, I actually can't find out any information behind why that change was made. So if someone out there actually knows about this, then I would absolutely love to hear from you. So Peter Baxter did that first ding ding ding, and then actually Viv Richards and Gary Sobers, so you know, upping the ante a bit in terms of household name, were the next two people on the next 2 days of that test match to ring the bell. Now, in terms of the bell itself, we're a podcast for everyone, amateur campanologists included, and so I've got some good information on the bell. If you look closely at pictures of it, it says on it Warner and Sons, London, 1884. That doesn't refer to David Warner, I'm reliably informed. It refers to a metalworking business in London dating back to the 18th century, whose most famous bell is actually Big Ben, the bell at the Houses of Parliament. So that's how Big Ben and Lords are connected, if you ever get that question in a pub quiz. Bells from Warner and Sons have ended up as far afield as Wellington in New Zealand. Now, the date on the bell, 1884, coincides with the first ever test match at Lords. So I assume that this bell was made for Lords for the first test match, rather than commemorating that test match. But again, details seem to be fairly sketchy on this, on the Warner Bell at Lords, which is situated just outside the bowler's bar at the north end of the pavilion. So the list of the people who have rung the bell since 2007 is a who's who of great cricketers and of cricket-loving celebrities. There's an amazing list actually on the Lords website, which is worth a browse because it's delightfully eclectic, and you find out about some interesting characters. There's a guy called Sam Loxton, who's an all but forgotten Australian all-rounder and politician. There's Eileen Ash, who is to this date, I think, the oldest living international cricketer. Sorry if I've cursed you, Eileen. There are great characters of the game, like Dickie Bird, the umpire. There are great fans, like Stephen Fry. But there are also nice moments, like Phil Neal, who was until recently the operations manager of the England team, was given a chance in the spotlight to ring the bell. And then, of course, there are just a ridiculous list of the great, from Warne to Wacko Yunus to Graham Pollock to Ponting to Rodney Marsh. I mean, I could just sit here and reel them off. It seems to be an unwritten rule that you only ring the bell once. And so there was quite a lovely moment when Andrew Strauss's children, Sam and Luca, rang the bell in honour of their mother, who died, Ruth Strauss, who died of cancer. Strauss himself had rung the bell back in 2014.
My sort of recollection of it always is as a kind of, it almost has a sort of religious feel to it when it goes. It feels like the sort of ceremonies commence kind of thing. And it's often when you're at a county game at Lords and it's rung, it's often the moment when you think, oh God, you know, if you've been ambling around the ground, you know, this is your moment to get back to your seat, you know, your finish your chatting and snacking. Serious cricket is back.
Well, I think there is something in the fact that we think of bells mostly in connection to churches. There is something about the ceremony of them and the sense of occasion and the sense of sort of moment that they bring. What's interesting is that actually ringing the bell is not easy. If you watch, as I have done, watch the YouTube clips of multiple people ringing the Lord's bell, the number of people who muck it up is quite considerable. There was quite an amusing moment back in 2012 when David Lloyd was doing the honours on the third day of the test match. He was following on from a couple of Olympians, Johan Blake and Peter Wilson. Bumble, there's this quite amusing video of him, you know, he grasps the kind of rope and he looks into the crowd of people looking on and kind of needs advice on exactly what to do in order to make it ring. And there are a number of different techniques that people have displayed over the years as well. Lords did a series where they interviewed people about ringing the bell and what ringing the bell was like. And what's amusing is it kind of slightly backfires because all of them just breathe this massive sigh of relief and to say, oh, well, thank God I was actually able to make a sound out of it, because it's obviously become this thing that people are slightly paranoid about whether they're actually going to be able to ring the bell properly or not.
There's clearly something hugely humiliating also about standing there enthusiastically trying to ring it with nothing happening in return. It's very interesting. I would have always assumed that it was one of those things that was reasonably hard to get wrong, but there you go. I my campanology needs work.
Well, I think the question is, from watching the videos, whether you pull or you push on the kind of on the rope, and you need to do a little bit of both. It's kind of a little bit counterintuitive, because you think that you have to hit the knocker on both sides of the bell, but in fact you just have to hit it repeatedly against one side. Anyway, Andy, there's your great tip for when you end up being invited to ring the Lord's bell. Now you'll know what to do. There have been some moments when it's been used in jest as well. I remember Courtney Walsh. I couldn't actually find any footage of this, but I remember vividly watching Courtney Walsh coming off the field of play and ringing the bell in humour at the end of the day, and all of the members turning around and looking in kind of abject shock at this breach of protocol that he had brought about. And I think that actually, you know, it's become such a ceremony that the moments when it goes wrong or something different happens are kind of almost more noteworthy than the moments when it necessarily goes to plan as well.
I would have worried if I was Courtney Walsh that would bring some sort of old MCC punishment. You know, there'd be something in the bylaws that would lead him to be, you know, instantly banned from cricket to cricket for life. But it sounds like he was able to continue with his career with nothing other than a few upset members.
So, like all good traditions, it's been emulated around the world. In 2016, Sourav Ganguly, the great Indian batsman and the president of the Cricket Association of Bengal, announced that Eden Gardens would get a bell like Lord's, and that it would be rung by either players who are playing in the match or by ex-cricketers. Kapil Dev had the honour of ringing the bell for the first time in a test match in September 2016. And it's turned into this enormous occasion. If you look up pictures of it, you see these kind of ceremonies where they put up a whole stage behind the bell. There are these enormous garlands of flowers, you know, hundreds of people watching on. There's a whole lot of razzmatazz and spectacle that sits around it. So whereas the Lord's tradition is now a little bit of part of the fabric, what's wonderful is the way that Eden Gardens has turned it on, you know, turned it into this enormous event and occasion.
I think what's one thing that's really lovely about it is that increasingly the trend to cricket has become a bit more, within the entertainment of the sport, has become a bit more rock and roll, obviously. So you watch the IPL and music's very loud, etc., which is all very fun and is all part of the sport and fits with it. But there's something rather nice about something as understated as the ringing of a bell to announce the action. You know, no fire machines, no loudspeakers, just something simple and enduring.
The Review, and this episode we have been reading On Cricket by Mike Briddy. It was published in October 2018. Briddy is considered by many to be England's greatest captain, and after he retired, he built a successful career as a psychoanalyst. This book is a collection of his essays and his articles on the game, and it ranges from everything from reverse swing to Samuel Beckett. Andy, how would you describe Mike Briddy as a writer?
He is first and foremost a thinker, and he writes a bit like he speaks, I guess, like many of us do. I saw him at an event at Daunt's Bookshops in London a couple of years ago, and he is incredibly cerebral, you know, thinking deeply about everything, which is absolutely fascinating. But I think it does occasionally have the drawback as a writer that it can occasionally be a bit ponderous. You know, this isn't a man with the elegance or the flair of, say, a Gideon Hay or a Duncan Hamilton, but the depth and also the breadth is extraordinary. So you have Macbeth referenced in a piece about Muhammad Amir. You have Freud invoked in a piece about Steve Smith and the sandpaper. This is a man who's not he's not going to be hemmed in by his subject. How did you feel he treats others in his writing? Because quite a lot of this is profiles. It's stuff about the players he's watched and the players he's played with.
Yeah, and there is a really interesting sense of balance, I think, that comes through, and there's a sense of a sort of lack of judgment as well. And it actually struck me reading this that I got closer to what I think made him so liked as a captain. You know, the fact that both of them trusted him so much and everyone who played with him trusted him so much is because he seems to take people on their own merits and to sort of, I mean, it sounds like a really Pollyanna-ish thing, but to sort of look for the good in everyone. So it's interesting when he writes about Alan Knott, deeply eccentric character. He doesn't treat his eccentricities as something to sort of poke fun at. He treats them them as something that's a genuine part of someone who he really likes. He also doesn't disparage not for going on the rebel tour of South Africa, even though we know that Brearley was deeply against that. And he calls Knott's decision well thought out, courteously expressed and tenaciously held. So it's interesting there that he doesn't decide to go down the route of trying to make a point. He goes down the route of trying to showcase the people that he's writing about to their best ability, I think.
I think you're right. There's a kindness and generosity in how he views everyone. And I think it's quite refreshing in the sense that there's a lot of modern, certainly modern cricket autobiographies where, you know, you build profile through your book by being outrageous. There is nothing outrageous about this. I think through the book, you obviously get a very in-depth sense of how he views cricket. And there is a moment where he talks in detail about why he thinks the preamble in the Laws of the Game referencing the spirit of cricket is important. And I think this really sums Brearley up, because in some ways, this is such a technical, dry topic. You know, what goes in the preamble of the Laws of the Game? But it matters to Brearley because detail matters to him. And it also shows him at his best, I think, because he is so precise. He's very clear on saying, you know, I know people think of the spirit of cricket as very woolly, but this is exactly what I think it does and what it doesn't do. And it's that sort of precision that that almost kind of scientific academic precision that shines through.
Do you think he's at his best when he's being theoretical or when he's being technical? Because he can be a very cerebral writer. He can write about big concepts. As you say, he can write about things like the spirit of cricket. There's a quite memorable last chapter to the book where he's in conversation with another can't even remember who it is that he's in conversation with. But it is deeply theoretical versus the moments when he's actually talking about being on the pitch and what it's actually like to bat, and when he analyzes the actions and the abilities and the technical abilities of certain cricketers. Did you have kind of feel a preference for one or the other style in his writing?
It's a really thin line, isn't it? I mean, I think we both commented on that final chapter. It's an interview with an artist called David Sylvester. And I think both of us, you know, we've got quite a high appetite and tolerance for cricket writing that's slightly flowery or that's willing to be about more than cricket. I think we're both comfortable with the idea that you can write a book about cricket that also says a lot about life, says a lot about art. But there are moments where he crosses over, and maybe it's inevitable for a psychoanalyst, but there is a moment in that interview where he talks about Oedipus complexes and batting, and I'm just not with him anymore. Like I don't believe it. I think this is intellectualizing to a point where
it's really interesting though, because one of the things that I actually found very powerful in that interview was the idea that he sets forward that when you're a batsman and you are really feeling in your groove, that you stop seeing the bowler as your opposition and you start seeing them as the person who enables your batting. So you stop thinking, I don't want them to bowl better because they might get me out. You start thinking, I want them to bowl better because that's going to make me bat better, and because I am so, like, we're two sides of a partnership rather than we're oppositional. And I thought that was a really interesting example of a moment where there was something kind of deeply theoretical about his thinking, but I actually thought that was quite a fascinating insight into, and quite an applicable insight into how you watch, because you watch some people bat, you watch Kohli bat when he is clearly just so in command of the situation and he is loving it. And you see that come through. He's loving it because he realizes that the bowler is there as part of a partnership with him, not as a kind of opposition to him.
Well, and I think this is almost it's a great example of, I think, when you think deeply about the game and when you particularly try to draw big comparisons between cricket and art or cricket and life more generally, I think sometimes you'll get it exactly right. And I think that point is that example of bowler and batsman as sort of a collaborative duo. It completely worked. I agree. It chimed with me as well. And there's the odd moment where you just push it perhaps a little far, or perhaps push it to a point where it may make sense to some, but for other readers, it may just not quite chime with. But I think that willingness to do so is, you, even when you disagree with Brearley, I always felt I was there for the ride. I always wanted to sort of see where his rather unusual mind was going to take us.
So Brearley is an Oxbridge, I can't remember, Oxford or Cambridge, but one of them educated, England cricketer that's gone on to be a bit of an intellectual. You expect him to be of a certain sort of traditional mindset, I suppose, in a way. He proves himself through this book to be a bit of an innovator, I think, in the way that he thinks, and then in his reflections on the on his own time playing the game as well. One of the things that I thought was quite interesting was him talking about the switch hit and why he actually sort of likes the switch hit, because, as he said, he would rather err on the side of quixotic experimentation than a routine respectability, and his desire to kind of safeguard the game, but not always to do that by being stuck in the mud, sometimes to need to do that by being innovative, I think was a really interesting, certainly something that I learned about his way of thinking through this well, book.
I think his approach to the switch hit is really interesting as well, in terms of saying that the game as a whole is richer for it, which does feel like a good way to measure these innovations. I mean, I also love the fact that he considers himself responsible for two rule changes. So yes, the fact that a team may forfeit an innings was a result of one declaration that he made in a county game. And I also love this story about how, because the rule is that if a ball hits the helmet, it's 5 runs, Brearley abused that rule rather wonderfully by placing the helmet all over the field to tempt, in his words, parsimonious Yorkshiremen. And in the end, as a result of such experimentation, you must now place the helmet behind the wicketkeeper. So I think it's rather wonderful when you stretch the rules of cricket in such a way that the rules change in response to you.
So this is a 400-ish page book. I found that it kind of absolutely flew past because of the way that it's structured, which is a series of essays and articles, some of them grouped together into particular themes. But I found one of the things really, really great about it is that you can pick it up and sort of dip in and dip out. I ended up, reading it in a couple of sessions. And I found that, we obviously read a lot of books for this podcast, and some of them give you new stories, new bits of history that you didn't know before, but it's very rare that we read books that actually make you think about the game as a whole slightly differently. And for me, that's what this book did. It did actually give me a bit of a fresh perspective on the game of cricket.
Thanks for joining us for the 131st episode of Reverse Sweat Radio. If you enjoyed what you heard, do go and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can find us on Twitter at Reverse Swept, and we'll be back in a few weeks' time.